and we're just on the beginning stage. Okay, so this will take us on, let's see, to page 8. Page 8. So on page 8, he is giving a little description. If you look at the second paragraph, beginning with the word first. So he's giving a little rundown of what's been going on. First of all, the devotee develops a little faith. It means to have some trust in Shastra. And it means that some desire is there to get a little involved in Krishna consciousness, something like that. That's the beginnings. Then, this faith leads one to take shelter of a spiritual master and associate with affectionate, like-minded devotees, associate with advanced devotees. In other words, sadhu sangha. And then, in association of devotees, one feels inspired, let me get into it myself and do it. So that means bhajana kriya, doing devotional service, taking it up. But now, a problem arises. The problem is that one has many bad habits from previously. Now one is trying to get into devotional service. But these bad habits will tend to upset your getting more and more into Krishna consciousness. They'll interfere. You won't just get into Krishna consciousness and that'll be that. But there are stumbling blocks on the way. So now he's going to discuss about stumbling blocks. And at this point he's going to discuss stumbling blocks which are related to such a devotee who is basically just beginning and just getting into it, not very advanced at all, but still they're trying to be devotees. So this is very relevant. Of course, you're all very advanced devotees. So you, but you at least may know someone who these stumbling blocks might refer to. And who knows, you might even face some yourselves, but I know that's very unlikely. But let us just discuss what are these initial stumbling blocks. And he even says, let's see, it's about the fourth or fifth paragraph down. Next comes bhajana kriya. So, bhajana kriya. Oh, yeah, okay. I'll just do this one. Bhajana kriya is of two types, unsteady and steady. So steady actually means number 5, nishtha, actually. But anyway, it's been separated as a separate stage because it is quite distinct from bhajana kriya in the sense that you're just beginning devotional activity. So there, he says, unsteady performance of devotional activities, unsteady bhajana kriya, is of 6 types in sequential order. So there's a sense of one following the other, like that. It's not necessarily completely like that, but there tends to be a sense that as a person's getting into devotional service, first of all, they'll encounter this problem. And then secondly, they'll tend to encounter the next one. And then like this. It tends to be like that. And these are very interesting things. So, the next paragraph, you'll see, begins with the word utsaha, my youth. Right? So just mark next to that, number 1. That is number 1. And while we're at it, in the next paragraph, you see the word ganatarala at the beginning. Just put a number 2 by that. And the next paragraph, yudhavikalpa, put a number 3 by that. And then there's quite an extensive discussion of yudhavikalpa, and we'll come to number 4 when we come to it. But anyway, here we are with utsaha, mayi. Now, utsaha means enthusiasm, actually. Rupa Goswami in Upadeshamrita, he says, utsaha nischaya daryat. You should be enthusiastic. This is a very good thing. So here we're talking about enthusiasm, but utsaha mayi. Mayi means maya, an illusory, false type of enthusiasm. And he gives the example like a child. A child starts his study, and after a few days he thinks he knows everything. He knows ABC, so he thinks he knows He can read Shakespeare or whatever, like that. So the idea is that when a person first takes to devotional service, they may very well have the tendency to feel they're more advanced than they are. And this is a problem. This is a problem. So he becomes utsahamai, or filled, puffed up with enthusiasm. A couple of little stories we have, you may have heard them, to illustrate such a mentality. There's one story of Srila Prabhupada meeting one man in Bombay, and the man was telling Prabhupada that, "Swamiji, I am liking Bhagavad Gita too much." People don't say that here, but in India, Indian people, they express themselves like that. They really like something, they say they like it too much. So anyway, that's all right. But it's kind of amusing. "Oh, I like Bhagavad Gita too much. I'm liking Bhagavad Gita too much." And Prabhupada was appreciating. Then the man said, "Especially that part when Lord Krishna tells Arjuna at the end that now you've heard everything. So now you do whatever you like." So that part, "Oh, I'm liking that too much." So that's a true story. And this is utsahamai, a false type of enthusiasm. That you think you know a lot more than you do. And you think you've got it all clear and you're doing well. But actually you're not. Then another story, which some of you will have heard, which I thought was a really good story, was in Amsterdam. Prabhupada went there first in 1972. There was actually a double garage in the red light district. And we went there on Padyatra in 1991. You have to close your eyes and sort of, because, you know, it's really a red light district. You may never have seen such a thing. I mean, you're very fortunate. But it's bizarre. It's wild. And it was right in the middle there, a double garage. And going back about two or three car lengths. In fact, it had been like a lubrication thing for a petrol station. So anyway, Prabhupada was there. And they were, I don't know if they're installing deities or it was initiation or what it was, but Prabhupada was going to do it by a sacrifice. So, and it was being televised live to Holland, all of Holland. So there they were, and the devotees were really messing things up. Building the fire, the oven kund or whatever, and trying to get it together, but they weren't getting it together. And Prabhupada was sitting there, getting more and more angry. In the end, they said, "All right, Prabhupada, we're ready." Prabhupada said, "Where's the fruit? Where's the fruit? Bring the fruit now." Because you're meant to decorate with fruit and vegetables. So that there was no fruit. So the temple president thought, "Wow, the fruit. Get the fruit now. Okay." He ran into their kitchen, which was, I don't know, just some little room on the side. He told the devotees, "Prabhupada wants the fruit. Where's the fruit?" So the devotees panicked. Right, fruit. They grabbed fruit. But then they thought, "Prabhupada doesn't eat whole fruit." So they made a fruit salad. In about 2 minutes flat. Prabhupada saw this. He just thought, "It's too much." So he just looked aside like this, and he was just going like that. So standing next to the Vyasa stand was one young hippie boy. Long hair, beard. But he was into Krishna consciousness a bit. He's in this stage with Sahamai. So there he was, you know, age. Watching it all going on, chanting on his beads, watching Prabhupada getting more and more angry. Then finally sees Prabhupada is just too much, and Prabhupada just looks away. He just doesn't want to know any longer. So this boy He was watching Prabhupada right next to him. He leaned over and said, "Shuddha Prabhupada, just chant Hare Krishna." One is not meant to advise or instruct someone like Srila Prabhupada. But anyway, Prabhupada picked up his beads and started chanting. So this is an example of Utsahamayi. So, anyway, it's an interesting one. So, we may know someone who's a little bit like that. They tend to know everything. And we may sometimes feel that we also know more than we do. Then next, it tends to follow after, although not necessarily, but the idea is that it may be like the next step. I mean, not that it means that by the time you come to Ganatarala that you are done with pride. There's no more pride. That is extremely unlikely. But tends to be like the next thing to become prominent. So this means, as you see right at the end of the little description, condensed, diluted, thick, thin. In other words, the devotee getting into Krishna consciousness a little bit, not that much, but a little bit. And the devotee is thinking, wow, this Krishna consciousness is great. I'm going to get up at 2 in the morning and just chant. So he gets up at 2 in the morning and he's chanting and chanting and chanting. And he's thinking, wow, this is great, which is nice. But he's chanting up in, perhaps in the Brahmachari ashram, or in the Brahmacharini ashram if it's a lady, or like this. And so there's so many other devotees around, and they're hearing this chanting going on at 2 o'clock in the morning. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Very enthusiastic. So one sort of little bit heavy devotee gets up and says, "Hey you, stop chanting so loudly, what are you doing?" Gets on his case. And the poor devotee thinks, what is this? Oh my God. So next morning, he doesn't get up till 7 o'clock. And when he gets up, it's only winter sun. So thick, thin. Like that. Enthusiastic. Then some obstacle comes and oh my God, what to do? Disaster. So we may be like that. Sometimes we're into it, something goes wrong, and then we think, oh gosh, Krishna consciousness. You know, maybe I have to chant my rounds, but like this. We may tend to be like that when we meet obstacles. Let's see. Then next is Yudhavikalpa. It's a very interesting one. Yudhavikalpa. In fact, he presents the idea of what Yudhavikalpa is in the form of a conversation with himself. This neophyte devotee is now encountering the fact that he has material desire. And, of course, it could be any material desire. But in this particular case, the desire, the attraction to the opposite sex, which is not unusual. So he's encountering this. So he's wondering what to do. So the basic, if you follow the conversation, it's very interesting. Shall I just spend my life happily in family life, making my wife and children Krishna conscious and worshipping the Lord? Or should I give them all up and go to Vrindavan? Or live in the temple or something like that. But basically give them up and just get into Krishna consciousness. And perfect myself by hearing and chanting without being distracted. Or shall I wait until the last stage? After I've enjoyed pleasure and I've finally understood that pleasure, material pleasure, is not really so good. And then I can renounce in a more natural way. So what should I do? Should I renounce right now? Maybe I should, because there are certain evidences, like the next verse. This is Srimad Bhagavatam, ladies, so please feel offended. Association with women is the way to death. Help. and for women, association with men is the way to death. So women are not simply being singled out here, but it's a principle. So now he's thinking, maybe I should renounce. Or she may be thinking, maybe I should renounce, because the opposite sex, whichever one it happens to be, they are problematic. I get attached, I get caught up in material life. So maybe I should just renounce. And so then he goes on, over to the next page, discussing with himself. Maybe I should just give this all up. But, see, now his viewer-the-culper, it means inability to make a decision. Flip-flop. Do this. Tomorrow, no, don't do it. Do the opposite. Next day, oh, I'll do it again. Following day, no, I won't do it again. So maybe I should just give up family life. Or on the other hand, is it proper to? Maybe I should wait till my parents have died. Alas, my parents are old. We should have a drama on this show. But I guess I'm acting it up myself. My parents are old, and my wife has our baby in her arms. And without me, what are they going to do? And not only that, but if one gives up family life unsatisfied, if one hasn't really expressed one's material desires, then when I renounce, I may still think about family life or whatever material things I'm attracted to. And in this way, I may not be able to get into spiritual life. So if I die in that condition, I'll go to hell. That sort of renunciation is very bad, he goes on to say. But then he does another flip-flop to the other side, down about two-thirds of the way down. In whatever ashram the sannyasi stayed, they always gave him more than enough to eat. Interesting idea. Actually, it's true. I'm afraid to say. In the life of renunciation, there's no worry for maintenance. So therefore, I can renounce. Why do I need to worry about it so much? I can renounce. I'll be all right. So maybe I should renounce. But on the other hand, they're going back again. Until people become your devotee, their material attachments remain thieves. But household life is a prison only for those who are attached. So he doesn't know what's going on. And some of us, we may also go through the same dilemma in this specific regard, because this is a very common one. Because everyone has attraction to the opposite sex. And this is an important question. It's not a joke, actually, in a sense. I mean, in the sense that it's a reality. When we look at a person going through these motions, it seems a little comical. But it's a very important question. Should I become a householder or not? Or remain a householder or not? What position should I take? It's an important question. And there are other questions, too. Should I, if you're living in a temple, should I do this service or that service? Should I stay in Durban? Or go to Vrindavan, or Johannesburg, or Cape Town, or whatever. We are all faced with choices. It's not at all uncommon what to do in Krishna consciousness. So, viuddhavikalpa, this tends to be the third type of dilemma the neophyte devotee encounters. So, of course, how to overcome that one? One should take shelter, particularly of the spiritual master if one has one, or take shelter of the devotees, the older devotees, things like that. Then one can get direction. So that takes us through page 9. Takes us on to page 10. And at the top of page 10 is number 4, Vishaya Sangara. Vishaya Sangara. It actually translates, so you can mark that number 4. You see that? Top of page 10. Literally it translates, Vishaya means sense gratification. Sangara means combat. So this is quite a dramatic term. War with Maya. declaring war on Maya, declaring war on sense gratification, fighting with Maya. So what does fighting with Maya mean? It means we have attachments, but in this case, the person is thinking, right, no more material attachments. Like, eat, sleep, mate, and defend. These are the fundamental material attachments. Eat, sleep, mate, defend. So this Vishaya Sangra means that the devotee who's getting into Krishna consciousness a little bit more now and is thinking, yes, it's very good, I must make advancement. So the spirit, good spirit, is building up. So then the devotee notices that, oh, I've got these attachments, but now I'm going to get rid of them. So from sleeping 8 hours a day, the devotee thinks, right, 4 hours a night, maximum. I'm declaring war on Maya. No more sleeping, at least just 4 hours. So there's the devotee now up at 2 in the morning or 1 in the morning, chanting Hare Krishna. But there's a problem. Maya fights back. That's the root of the problem. And Maya is no mean enemy. Maya's pretty good enemy. So the devotee is now sitting in Srimad Bhagavatam class. But as soon as Jaya, the first line of Jayarada Nadava is sung, the devotee is out. We have seen such devotees. As soon as the devotee sits down anywhere, the devotee is out. And even when the devotee is up, the devotee is sort of fumbling around a bit. Because the devotee is not getting enough sleep. As soon as the devotee sits behind the wheel of a car, I remember driving along in England in the mid-70s once we were on traveling Sanditown, and there were three of us, one driving, two sitting next in a van, and the one in the middle was reading to the driver, Krishna consciousness. And just to make sure the devotee was awake, he would ask questions about what he just read. So I was reading those such and such Krishnas, this and that. And what was this point? Silence. Then he doesn't think too much. So he goes on reading Krishna. Krishna consciousness is this. And what did I just say? Silence. So we both looked over. And there was the driver. Fortunately, his hands were like this on the wheel, so the vehicle was going straight. So then you wake them up and they say, oh, I wasn't sleeping. So such things are going on. In a sense, it's nice because at least the devotee's trying. But the trying is not really in a balanced way. So the effect is not like there's no solid effect. Or the devotee is thinking, right, eating, big problem. So I'll only eat once a day. Or once every other day. And just a few mouthfuls. That's it. After a couple of days, the devotee is feeling very weak and fatigued and can't really do very much. And then the maha plate walks by. And the devotee thinks, well, Krishna consciousness is not meant to be just dry renunciation. And this prasad, this is Krishna. This is a form of the Lord. I'm renouncing the Lord. I can't do that. So immediately, kidnaps the maha. So then it's 5 meals a day, because it's all prasad. It's Krishna. You have to do it. Anyway, this is Vishaya Sangra. But as he says, in the first main paragraph, but many times his attempts at renunciation end in enjoying what he's trying to renounce. And then he quotes a nice verse from the Bhagavata. Knowing that sense gratification leads to misery, which is certainly a fact, even though he tries to give up his material desires, still he's unable. and he ends up enjoying the same thing he wanted to renounce. So this type of problem is there. It's a little bit more advanced problem now. It's one thing to have problems, but you should try not to have the same problem all the time. At least have a new problem. when you're in the lower stages, you can expect some problems. Don't think that tomorrow you're going to be an Uttamadikari, because it won't happen. Unless you are really someone very special. Or at least you make a very, very special effort. But generally we see that people go gradually through the process. This is 99% of the cases at least. So problems will be there, but we have to try to learn how to deal with them maturely. So this is a little bit more advanced problem. At least he wants to renounce. In view of the kalpa, he didn't know whether he should renounce or not. But now at least he knows that I should renounce, even though he can't really do it very nicely. So now the next one, if you go down about one third of the way down the page, you see the word niyamakshama. So that's number 5. I hope you've got all the numbers so far. Niyamakshama. So niyama. Niyama refers to rules. So now, the devotee, previously, the devotee was trying to renounce material things. Now the devotee wants to accept spiritual things. Like, chant more. So now, 64 rounds a day. 64 rounds a day. Obeisances to every devotee whenever I see them for the whole day. And reading at least 3 or 4 hours. Something like this. The devotee is now taking vows. The previous vows in Vishaya Sangra were, I'm going to give up material things. But now the vows are, I'm going to accept extra Krishna conscious activity and in this way make extra advancement. But the devotee finds, you know, the second day, first day maybe struggles up to 50 rounds. Next day is up to 32 and he's thinking, wow, how am I going to do this? And next day he thinks, well, Prabhupada said 60. Which is true, Prabhupada said 60. And actually we should generally stick with that. Unless we have some opportunity really to increase our minds. Like that. But the idea is that the devotee is trying to increase the devotional practices. Obeisances to every devotee. So the devotee is going up and down, up and down, up and down. And after a while your knees hurt. And your body aches. Who's carries this? Okay, so the devotee is actually taking on more devotional activity than he or she is really capable of doing comfortably in a way which is going to help, and devotional service becomes very difficult. But it's a little bit more advanced problem than just fighting with sense gratification. Then next paragraph, Tarangarangani is number 6. Riding the waves. Riding the waves. Oh, how nice. So now the devotee has got more into it. The devotee is a little steadily situated in Krishna consciousness. And other people are noticing, oh, this devotee's doing okay. And some real neophytes may think, oh, very nice devotee. And this neophyte devotee, who's a little steady, is noticing that these people think that I'm quite a good devotee. So he thinks, yes, true. Yes, they have understood. Just to give a very good example, like this example, a devotee, they may not even be on the stage, but they may or may not. Someone joins the temple, shaves their head, puts on dhoti and kurta, and they've sort of got it on the right way. The young lady wearing a sari, and she's sort of basically coming to grips with how it should be, and Now she's going out on Sankirtan, door to door. Knock on her door. You've been a devotee for a month, perhaps, or something like that, living in the temple. Knock on the door, you're distributing books. Person opens the door, and they think, oh, the Swami has come. Or at least lavish some treatment on him or her. And the devotee thinks, oh, this is very good. I'm glad I became a so, riding the wave. Oh, very nice. But they're just very small waves, just on the edge of the ocean of devotional service. But the devotee is thinking, now I've made it. So this is Tarunda Ramini, riding the waves. So now we'll go on. Let's see. Yes, we'll carry on for a little while. And we'll go on to chapter 3. Chapter 3. This is now about Anathanavritti, which is stage number 4. So Anathanavritti, if you recall yesterday, we told you it means clearing away all the unwanted things. Now the devotee is committed to devotional service. They're really seriously practicing, and they're making a little headway. So now they have to clean out not just these things. These are more like sort of childish problems. They're also anathas. They're more like childish types of anathas, real neophyte problems. Now the devotee becomes confronted with more serious unwanted things, which really have to be cleared away. So these are more serious problems. And the process of clearing them away, which actually allows you then to come to the point of really being fixed, this is called anathanivritti. Artha means something which is wanted, and anatha means something which isn't wanted. So, we'll write over here. The first paragraph tells us that there are 4 types. So you mark these. And remember where they are, because when we have our test, if we have our test, you'll have to look these up. So at least know where they are, even if you don't know them all. So there are 4 types. Anathas, unwanted things, which arise from previous sin. Unwanted things which arise from previous piety. Unwanted things which arise from offences. Unwanted things which arise from, says bhakti. Not exactly bhakti, because bhakti is pure. But the idea is, the 4th one. Unwanted things which arise from mistakes that you make while you're performing your bhakti. They're not really bad enough to be offences, but they're like errors. Oh, this is okay for the time. Yeah, so you could say mistakes in bhakti. This is more the idea. Because bhakti is the very thing which we're trying to develop. So bhakti is the cure to our problems. Bhakti can't really be a cause for our problems. So then he goes on to elaborate, give a little description of each one of these 4 types in the next paragraph. So anathas arising from previous sin, pretty simple. Those 5 kleshas, tendency to identify with your body and be materially attracted, and to dislike things which get in the way of your material sense gratification. Or in other words, like attraction to sinful life, the attraction to breaking the 4 regulative principles. So every devotee in the initial stages certainly feels some attraction to, you know, breaking the regulative principles, actually. It takes some time before one gets free from those attractions. So this type of attraction which you may feel, this is what is meant by anathas arising from your previous sin. Your previous sin, it's ingrained in you. So you still have the tendency to be attracted to the opposite sex or to, you know, whatever bad habits you may have had in the past. Then the 2nd one, which is also in the same paragraph, is a rather interesting one. and that is arising from your previous piety. Yesterday we were discussing how your piety, your good karma, cannot lead to bhakti. Here it's saying that actually your previous piety may actually stop your advancement in bhakti. So not only is it not really a cause of your getting into devotional service, but it can actually be something which is perverse. Now this means, I'll give you an example. Like we mentioned yesterday about Mother Archanegra. Because of her piety, she became attracted to devotional, or the association of devotees was like a door, we said. So then she went there. And she saw the devotees were having a feast, which was not exactly, you could say, in the mode of goodness as much as she might have expected, as much as she was used to. It was very rich and very sweet and very heavy. Of course, it's transcendental. Anyway, that's our excuse. But on a certain level, material level, it would look like, you know, a rather sort of heavy, extravagant, and something like that, possibly, form of vegetarianism, rather than just fresh fruits, steamed vegetables, and like that. You get the idea? Yeah. So, this type of... So, piety may be an anatta. It may actually become opposed to our Krishna consciousness. Or you may be living in a temple, of course not so many of you are, but you may be living in a temple in the middle of a city, like sunny Hillbrow. Living in sunny Hillbrow. And you may think, and it's true, it's in the middle of a dirty, noisy city. It's a fact. And you may think that this isn't very nice. All the smog, occasionally people getting shot, and, you know, all these things, prostitution and liquor and all this, nightclubs. And I don't like that sort of thing, because you are more in the mode of goodness. So then you may think, yes, let me leave this temple and go to the country ashram, which of course we don't have at present, but anyway, if there was one, you might think, let me go and join the country ashram. Then I can go and chant with the cows. And just enjoy the fresh air and, you know, like this. So you may think, oh, it's a Krishna-conscious alternative. So you're attracted to that because of your piety. You're not attracted to the city. Someone who's less pious, they will want to be in the city, right in the center of it all. But a person who's more pious will prefer a more natural environment. But in this case, like particularly if your spiritual master has told you, you go to the Hillbrow Temple and you serve there. But now you're thinking, no. It's too dirty, etc. Then this becomes anatta. Even though it's a tendency towards piety. You follow the idea? Yeah. This is an interesting and rather subtle anatta. Then offences. You turn over to page 11. There's a lengthy discussion about offences, because they're the worst. They're the worst type of anatta. And they produce the worst types of anattas within you. They're very dangerous. Now, I know that you're all studying about offences with Parthasarathy Guru, so I won't go into it in great detail, although Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur does. The whole of this page and the whole of the next page, it's all dedicated to this. But the idea is that if you commit offences, then that is anatta, that is unwanted, and it will produce effects in you which are unwanted. So, let's see. Now there are a couple of interesting points though, which I don't know, this may be repeating what you've been hearing from part of it. We'll mention it anyway. If you turn over to page 12. The second paragraph. If the nam aparadhas, either long-standing or recent, whatever they are, have been committed unconsciously, then you just chant Hare Krishna. If you're not aware, of course, you can know that you must have been committing offences, because you won't be experiencing prema. Are any of you experiencing prema? Anyway. No. So what does that mean? It means we are all committing offences. But if I were to ask you, what offences did you just commit yesterday? Then you might, in all honesty, say, well, I don't know, actually. The thing is, you can understand that you must have been committing offences, because now you're not experiencing bhava, at least. Let us say, not prema, okay, but not even bhava. You're not experiencing. Your ears are not standing on it. Anyway, so therefore you can understand. You can understand. But anyway, if you don't know what your offences are, but you know that you must have been committing them because you're not experiencing bhava, then just chant Hare Krishna and just carry on. But if you know the last sentence in this paragraph, if offences are committed in full knowledge, then you have to worry about it. You have to do something. Then he goes on to discuss 4 of the 10 offences. First, and at greatest length, offences to devotees, and we know you're just studying this all with Partha, so we're not going to go through it in detail. But, again, we will just mention a couple of points. Let's see. If you look in not the next paragraph, the paragraph beginning with however. This is just, it's like a detail, but it's an interesting detail. If you look at the 4th line down, nor should one be of the mentality to think that the offense of offending devotees discriminates between types of devotees. So it doesn't mean only that if you offend a very advanced devotee, then that's a problem. But it also includes, if you offend, if you go down a couple more lines, a person cannot minimize his offense by pointing out some defect in the devotee who you've offended. So you, it's one thing if you offend a very advanced devotee, then you, anyone would know, any devotee would know this is an offense. But if you know some devotee who is not doing very well, actually they may be doing very badly, they may be breaking the regulative principles. And if you try and tell them that, look, you shouldn't do this or that, then they may tell you, well, it's none of your business, you get out. Or something like that. And then you think, oh, what a rascal, what a nonsense. So you, just the fact that the person is not very advanced, and they may actually even have some serious problems, doesn't mean that you can just say, oh, he or she's a nonsense and they're just rubbish and I don't care. No, that is also a offense. He explains. Anyway, I'll just explain the principle which is involved. The principle involved is that there are 26 qualities of a devotee. One of them is, and this is the first one, that the devotee is attached to Krishna. And then there are others, like the devotee's humble, tolerant, merciful, etc. But there's only one which is very specifically connected with Krishna. That is that the devotee is a devotee, that they're attached to Krishna. So the principle is that as long as the person is attached to Krishna, even if they're lacking in mercy, tolerance, peacefulness, kindness, sweet speech, and all these other things, which are actually secondary qualities, even if they're very lacking, they're very intolerant, they're very proud, they're very ready to get angry, but at least they're attached to Krishna, then you can't commit offences. Even if you do something and you say, well, look, the person is a useless devotee, so why bother? Then this is wrong. So this is a little detail to remember, which I thought I'd mention. So then he goes on to talk about the other, three other of the 10 offences, and we're not going to discuss them because I think you're pretty much familiar with the 10 offences. So So is it all right if we carry on for another 10 minutes? I know you're a bit angry. Not so many of you falling asleep, so that's a good sign. Is that all right?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I suppose you had to say that. You're a good student. Very nice. You're probably all passed. Okay, so now next, if you turn to page 50, there's a lengthy description of anatta arising from offense that we haven't yet discussed about the fourth one. And if you look in the second paragraph on page 15, it refers to this fourth one. Anatta's arising from bhakti or from your mistakes while you're performing bhakti. So it's actually quite similar to Tarangarangani, that as you're performing devotional service, certain bad habits may come in. You may become respected by the other devotees or some people. Someone may offer you respect, and you may think, yes, you have understood correctly. Or something like that. Now, the difference is, there appears to have to be no difference. But there is a difference. On the level of Tarangarangani, the point is that the person is more looking for these things. Whereas in this case, because this is a little bit further on, the devotee is actually a little bit more advanced. So these things are coming. The devotee is not looking for them, but they're coming. And the devotee is just like, without noticing, becoming affected. So in this way, there's a difference between Tarangarangani, which means enjoying what comes from your bhakti, like appreciation and so on, and this, which means, in a sense, the same thing. Not that you're trying to enjoy it, though, but you're just being affected by it. So, like a devotee, well, you don't... Anyway, sometimes the devotees report their sankirtan scores. Someone may be very good, so their name is appearing in the newsletter, and they say, oh yes, here I am, number one, such and such dance, or whatever it may be. So, but then 1 week or 1 month, the sankirtan leader makes a mistake. Your name gets left out. So there you are looking, I should be number one, but wait a minute, I'm not even on the list. Hey, what happened? And then, I'm not going out. They don't appreciate me. And even if the devotee goes out, the devotee can't get together to get into it. So this means they've been getting a little bit of respect, but now somehow they've lost it, and now they're affected. So they became attached. They may not even have been looking for it, but they just became attached, just sort of fell into the trap. So this is the idea with anathas arising from bhakti, or like mistakes you make while you're performing bhakti. So now there's a very interesting section, next paragraph, stages in the nullification of these anathas. It's extremely scientific, it's quite amazing. So if you look at the next paragraph, four types of anathas have been mentioned, yes. And now there are five grades, or five stages in the nullification. Quite amazing, you see this? Limited to just one anatha or just a small part. You're getting free of the anatha, but just one small part of it. Then affecting many anathas, like a more general type of elimination of anathas. Then, an almost complete, you're actually getting rid of your anathas quite well. And then complete, becoming completely free from an anatha or a collection of anathas. Generally, we have our collections. What anathas do you have? Well, I committed a good offense the other day. Anyway. And then beyond complete is absolute. So absolute is like, really, quite something. So then the next sentence, thus immediately, you see that? After starting performance of devotional activities. Now, somehow there's a little mistake here. This is now describing the rate of nullification of anathas arising from offenses. So please make a note of that. He's saying that after starting your devotional activities, bhajana kriya, there is nullification, but it is limited. Now, this applies to the anathas arising from offences. Are you clear on that? Because the other types of anathas, there are four types, like the anathas arising from sin, previous sin and previous piety, they're nullified at a different rate. More speedily, actually. So now, here we're talking about the nullification or elimination of anathas arising from offences, the worst anathas. So when you begin your devotional activities, there is nullification, but it's very limited. Because until you begin your devotional service, you haven't really had a chance to commit any good offences, have you? In devotional service. Because you can only commit offences in devotional service when you're performing devotional service. Otherwise it would fall more into the category of sin. So only when you begin your devotional service do you really begin making offences. And actually the same principle applies with mistakes in bhakti. You can only begin making mistakes in bhakti when you're performing bhakti. Otherwise you can't make any mistakes in bhakti, obviously. So here, the nullification is limited on the level of bhajana kriya. But when you advance on, let's see, to the level of nishtha, by continued practice, you see that? When you come to the level of nishtha, then the eradication is pervasive. There's a fairly considerable, anyway, fairly noticeable at least, not that considerable, but it's a reasonably noticeable elimination of anatta. And when you come to the level of bhava, the eradication is almost complete, meaning it's really quite considerable. On the level of bhava, it was very advanced. I don't think any of us are on that level. It's very advanced. But the eradication is not absolute. It's not complete. It's just considerable. There's like a substantial elimination. Then on the level of prema, the eradication is complete, but it's not absolute. Just think how serious these offences are. And then he says, when you attain, where is it? With the attainment of the Lord's association, in other words, when you directly enter into your personal relationship with Krishna, only at that point is the eradication absolute or completely complete, like that. In other words, you could ask the question, why is a person on the level of bhava? Because if you look at our scale here, level of bhava means you left anathas behind four stages ago. Long, long way ago you left anathas behind. Anatha nivritti. They were basically nullified. Now why would a person on the level of bhava not be on the level of prema? If they're that elevated, it's an astonishing level to be on. Sometimes they're perceiving Krishna. Sometimes Krishna is appearing to them. Sometimes they're becoming overwhelmed with ecstatic symptoms, fainting, like that. So why would they not be on the level of prema? So the answer is, because there's still traces of anatta left from previous offences. So it's a pretty serious thing. Anyway, then if you go down to the third paragraph after this, the eradication of the anathas, you see that? Arising from previous sin. And this also applies to piety. Piety is not specifically mentioned, but sin and piety are like two sides of this same coin. So on the level of bhajana kriya, the eradication is limited. When you just start, the effects of your previous sin, your sinful tendencies, are just slightly reduced. Not that much reduced. But when you come to the level of nishtha, that means you're getting free of a lot of your anathas, then it's complete. And on the level of ruchi, It's absolute, totally gone, absolutely gone. So when a person comes to the level of nishtha, meaning they're really fixed in devotional service, the effects of their previous sin are gone, and therefore if there is any disturbance in their devotional service from that point on, generally it can only be because of offences. Otherwise, how could there be any disturbance? Because the effects of their previous sin and piety are absolutely gone. So I know this is a little technical, but personally I find it very interesting. So then the next paragraph... Oh, wait a minute, where were we? No, I just got a little mixed up there. Previous sin, well, not that it makes such a big difference to us, but with the appearance of nishtha, eradication is complete, and with the appearance of asakti, it's absolute. And then anatha is arising from bhakti. With the performance of vajra kriya, it's limited. Actually, I got myself really mixed up there, didn't I? Sorry about that. So previous sin, with the performance, when you begin your devotional service, the eradication is almost complete. Just when you begin. Because it means you're following regulative principles and you're trying to be a devotee and give up your bad habits like that. So just when you start devotional service, the eradication is almost complete. And then the eradication of your anathas arising from your mistakes in bhakti. When you begin devotional service, the eradication is limited. Because it's only when you begin devotional service that you can make some mistakes in devotional service. So therefore, on that level, the eradication is limited. But on the level of nishtha, it's complete. And on the level of ruchi, it's absolute. Anyway, interesting sequence there. So, let's see. Let us conclude by mentioning a couple of other points. He then discusses that people may object that the eradication should be quicker. It should be a lot quicker. Because there are statements, if you turn over to page 16, right at the top of the page, there are statements in Shastra and by the previous Acharyas to the effect that, like, in the first one, that if you chant the holy name once, all your sins are destroyed. That's Srinivasa, one of the great commentators. In the next translation, the next verse, O my Lord, simply by seeing you. So here it says that merely by hearing your holy name once, even a chandala can be liberated. So the first one was about chanting the holy name once. This one is about hearing the holy name once. Even a chandala, meaning someone who's terribly sinful, they're liberated immediately. They just hear the holy name once. So why should the process be so gradual? So slow even. And then he made the next paragraph, cite Ajamil's case. He just chanted the name of his child, Narayan, and he got liberated. So why are we saying that the elimination of anathas is so slow? Why? This is the objection. So then the next paragraph explains that this is all true. All these statements and the example of Ajamil, they're all true. The holy name has that effect. But, if there are offenses, then the holy name personally withholds. Just like we were mentioning yesterday, Bhakti Devi is a person. Bhakti is not just a thing like that. That you do in an impersonal sense. Bhakti Devi is a person. So the holy name is a person. So if you offend Bhakti Devi, or if you offend the holy name, Krishna, the person, then Krishna says, well, hang on a minute. Just take it easy there. And then you have to go through a process. What is that process? Of course, an interesting point actually, which occurs at the end of the same paragraph, that even though because of your offenses, the holy name is withholding and waiting until you've made greater effort, basically. Still, the last sentence says in that paragraph, still the servants of death have no power to attack you. And the example is Ajamil. So even though problems are there, still it's being a devotee and chanting is very advantageous. Then if you go down, not to the next, not the translation of this verse which follows, but the next paragraph, though this is true, So what do we do? What is the procedure? We're offending the holy name. Therefore, our nullification of our anathas is gradual. It's a little slow. So what do we do? It says that there's no means of purification other than becoming free from nama pariah. Don't think that I can go on committing offenses and eventually they'll just go away and I'll just find I'm not committing them any longer. No. You have to give them up. You have to say, all right, no more offenses, and that's it. They don't just dissolve it.